Okay. I've already been introduced. So what I'm going to do for a few minutes is vamp and mention what I did last time. So this is what I did in the first lecture, for those of you who aren't here. I stated the boundary rigidity problem, which I don't have to state again since Vladimir stated it this morning, although I will. I guess I will in a second. I mentioned some of the reasons why it's not always true and some of the history and the applications of it. I mentioned the lens rigidity problem, which is scattering data. Given the scattering data, can you recover the metric? And then I gave a proof, the only proof I'm going to give, in a particular case, in a conformal case, the isotropic case. So today I'm going to do, this is a survey lecture. I'm not sure, not planning to prove anything. I'm going to talk about a cut-and-paste method, which allows you to turn this problem into a global Riemannian geometry question, which probably doesn't hear that probably looks like a backwards way to do things, but nonetheless. And then I'll be talking about global geometry for a bit, the conjugacy rigidity question. Then there are some other questions, other inverse questions that it's related to, and try and mention some of the results that are known in higher dimensions, and then talk about the linearized and local problems. And then if time, there's even some volume questions I'm going to get to. So anyway, that's a quick outline while people are still getting here. And now I'll get rid of this until, if I have time at the end, I'll pull this back down and have a few slides. So to set it up, let me remind you briefly what was going on. Since not everyone's here yet, this is just a reminder. So the setup for the boundary distance function was a compact Riemannian manifold. And we had simple was, we had a couple of conditions because it wasn't always true. And simple is probably the one to remember. You can think of it as a ball with a convex boundary and all geodesics running across minimize. That would be the simple case as a reminder. And we saw last time that if you have two metrics, G1 and G2, and the boundary distance functions, which the distance function G1 is the distance, the chordal distance between two boundary points, shortest path between them along the inside, then the scattering data says, is if you know the incoming direction, scattering data tells you the outcoming direction and the transit time. So we saw that in the simple case and actually in the SGM case that the boundary distance functions being the same gave you the same scattering data. And that in turn gave rise to this conjugacy F. So F, so we had G0, G1, and here were the unit tangent bundle over here and the unit tangent bundle here. And we got a map F between the unit tangent bundles. And it, this is a little different notation than GT0, this is my notation for the geodesic flow. That is, you take the unit vector, if you flow it by time t and push it over, it's the same as first pushing it over and flowing it by time t. So we defined this last time. I guess that's easy enough. I'll do it again. You have a unit vector here. To find out where it goes, you follow the geodesic back to where it hits the boundary. Then you head off from the same boundary point the same amount of time, and you take the corresponding unit vector. That was the conjugacy. So as other people said before, you might have started with a domain in R3, and you have to really start considering manifolds for that problem. Now I'm going to do worse. I'm going to throw the boundary away. So now we're going to consider this problem, I claim, is really a local version of a global geometry question, which is the CK conjugacy rigidity question. So let me state this problem. So now we have a manifold without boundary. And these are compact Riemannian manifolds. And to emphasize it, they're without boundary. And they are called CK conjugate if there exists a CK diffeo F from the unit tangent bundle. What do I call them? 1 and 2? Nope, 0 and 1. 0 to 1, such that F commutes with the geodesic flow. This is a global. Now the geodesic flow is defined for all time. There's no boundary. So if your unit tangent bundles they have to be CK diffeomorphic in the first place, but if you have diffeomorphic unit tangent bundles that have time-preserving conjugacies, the same time, the question is, are they isometric? That again, it's a general question. It's not always true. So G0 is CK, this is the term, CK conjugacy rigid if for every G1, such that M1 G1 has a conjugacy, then G1 is isometric to G0. Right. So of course, you don't say the metrics are the same, because as usual is the pullback. If you have any diffeomorphism of your manifold, the pullback metric we'll have a conjugate geodesic flow by just using that diffeomorphism, the differential of that diffeomorphism to compare the metrics. So this is the question, which manifolds are CK conjugacy rigid? And before going too much further, why is it related to what we have? Is if you start off with a manifold that is CK conjugacy rigid, and take a simple subdomain D. It's sitting inside the global manifold. Then D is boundary rigid. So D is simple subdomain of CK conjugacy rigid implies D is boundary rigid. So that's why I think of the boundary rigidity question as a local version of the conjugacy rigidity question. It has to do with small domains. And what is what? Oh, why does this apply? Okay, I was going to say that. All right, so if there was another metric on D, say there was a, so D has a metric G0, namely just the restriction. If there was a G1, somewhere that had the same boundary distance function as D, but wasn't isometric. This is the cut and paste that I mentioned. You cut out D with G0 metric on it, and you glue in D1 with the D1 metric. Now, you already had a conjugacy between the geodesic flows. This map F was a conjugacy between the geodesic flows of the disks, of the balls. And if you just make it the identity outside of this, it gives you a global conjugacy. Right, so is that clear? So there are two metrics. There's this with the metric G0, and then there's a separate one with the metric DG1 stuck in. the conjugacy between the geodesic flows, the identity outside. But inside, it's this one here. And I said simple because if your metric is simple, it turns out that when this cutting and pasting gives rise to a C-infinity metric. This was proved by Shatafudinov relatively recently. It had been proved there was C2 by Michel in the early 80s. But even when it's not simple, most of the theorems I know of, in fact, all the theorems that I know of, that prove that the global manifold is conjugacy rigid, those don't need anything near as nice as smooth for this cut and paste argument. So the cut and paste argument works, if you were here for my first talk, almost always works for SGM subdomains of these conjugacy rigid. By the way, I say CK because there's a real difference between C1 and C0. C0 conjugacies and C1 conjugacies, there are different techniques, but for all I know, somebody might find something more subtle to look at, but C0 and C1 seem to be the big distinctions. Okay. I should say that early in the first talk, I mentioned some results about when things are boundary rigid. And those results, although at the moment there are other proofs, the early results about even Euclidean space, subdomains of Euclidean space, are proved by a global conjugacy. Now, there are other proofs now, but for instance, to show that a domain in the plane was boundary rigid, the first proof of that, you put it in a flat torus. You put in a big flat torus, close it up, and now you have a torus that has no conjugate points. And there is a theorem by Eberhard Hopf in the 40s that two tori without conjugate points are flat. So you forced the metric to be flat. So, but you were using the global properties of the two torus to prove that a subdomain of the plane was boundary rigid. And now the n-dimensional version of the Hopf conjecture was proved in the 90s by Burago and Ivanov. It had been open for a long time as a major question. But now you can also, although Gromov proved that subdomains of Rn are boundary rigid before the proof of the Hopf conjecture, you can use that also to prove subdomains of Rn by sticking them in a big N, flat N torus. And using the fact that flat N tori are conjugacy rigid. Anyway, I did mention a theorem that subdomains of a hemisphere, here's the only, not the only positively curved case now because of your theorem in two dimensions, but maybe I should say, I'll be careful about saying only. Here's an example where you have positive curvature when you have boundary rigid. If you took a closed subdomain of the open hemisphere, not allowed to go all the way to the boundary, but any closed subdomain of an open hemisphere, the metric was determined by its boundary distance function. And the only proof of that I know is the global proof that on an n-sphere, the only metrics such that geodesics leaving one point all coalesce again at an opposite point, which is what happens on the sphere, these are so-called Blaschke spheres, that the only spheres with this property are the round spheres. This was the Blaschke conjecture for spheres. It was proved by Berger and Kasdan. And a bunch of other names that should be associated with it. They put the nail in the coffin. There was Warner and Alan Weinstein was involved with pieces of it. And C.T. Yang, a number of people. But anyway, this was resolved in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. So that so the point was, if you had a thing that was stuck there, you would duplicate it on the other side, the metric, this new metric that was supposed to, your candidate metric with the same boundary distance function. If you duplicated it on the other side, you'd end up creating a sphere with this global property. And then you apply the global theorem. So again, it was the cut and paste method that proves boundary rigidity. No, it's Gromov's proof is, I almost put it in quotes. He proves a volume inequality, and it's the equality case of the volume inequality, but he never goes through the argument. You know, it's sort of not there. But there are other arguments like that that are volume arguments. But it's not global. It's a filling volume argument. But it isn't of this type. No, it's done just on the manifold with boundary itself. The ones that are rigid? Well, okay. The ones where the proofs exist, actually, it's not quite true. Flat tori, in fact, if they're conjugate, they're isometric. They have conjugate geodesic flows. But you can create conjugacies that don't cover the identity map, but don't cover an isometry. So a priori, you certainly don't assume these conjugacies cover anything. I gave you the argument last time that I would force it to be isometric. So we don't assume the conjugacy might not be. Yeah, there's no a priori reason. Oh, sure. If it's two-dimensional, I mean, there's a lot of things that are true, right? The unit tangent bundles are diffeomorphic. That says a lot about the underlying topologies being the same. Doesn't say they're equal, by the way. I don't actually have a counterexample to this, but I know they exist. That just because you have the same unit tangent bundle, it doesn't mean you're the same manifold. Certainly does in two dimensions mean that you're the same manifold. In higher dimensions, it certainly means the fundamental groups are the same, which is all we ever use in this talk. But it doesn't actually imply the manifolds are diffeomorphic a priori in high enough dimensions. But it does say a lot. Right? It's a diffeomorphism on the unit tangent bundles. That says the spaces are pretty much the same spaces underlying. So let me mention. So today's a day of related questions, some results and a bunch of related questions. But a couple other related questions. You could ask about the eigenvalue spectrum, So now we've gone to manifolds without boundary. So the natural boundary condition being that they're compact. So you've got an elliptic operator and the eigenvalues are a discrete set of eigenvalues as usual. But here I mean eigenvalue, the Laplace-Beltrami operator, of course. So you could ask whether the eigenvalue spectrum determines the metric, which it doesn't, of course. There are lots of counterexamples. But to what extent, what kind of information comes out of this? I'll say something about that. There's the length spectrum. So the length spectrum of a compact manifold is a set of lengths of closed geodesics. If you have conjugate geodesic flows, it will take the tangent vector field to a closed geodesic over to the tangent vector field to a closed geodesic of the same length. So conjugacy implies that they have the same length spectrum. How much information can you get out of that? There's the marked length spectrum. And this marked, you're marking your lengths. And this It usually shows up in manifolds of negative curvature, but you can define it for any manifold. So the Mark length spectrum is a map from homotopy classes, free homotopy classes of so S1 into R plus, which just tells you the length of the shortest closed curve in that homotopy class. So for negative curvature, there's exactly one closed geodesic in each homotopy class, and it's just the length of that closed geodesic. So the difference between, in that case, between the length spectrum and the marked length spectrum is you remember which homotopy class it came from. So it's a function, not just the image of the function. So it includes, of course, multiplicities, and but even more than that. So these are things that you might, that we'll see are all related to this conjugacy question, and in turn to the boundary rigidity question. I was going to say in the k less than zero case, how these are related, the Mark length spectrum the same implies there's C0 conjugate. So this is a theorem of Hammonstadt that if you have two metrics of negative curvature and they have the same Mark length spectrum, then in fact there is a C0 conjugacy. So, and of course, I should do that. The other way is, I'll just say that. The other way is essentially automatic, except in two dimensions. Maybe I'll have a dotted. In n dimensions, you're questioning about keeping track of the homotopy classes. And it maps on the unit tangent bundle, project down to maps on the base as far as the fundamental group's concerned, except in two dimensions where the unit sphere is a circle. In higher dimensions, it's simply connected, so it doesn't make any difference. The Mark length spectrum on the unit tangent bundle and downstairs is the same thing. Let me just say this. This is essentially true. So the Mark length spectrums and C0 conjugacy are the same thing in curvature less than zero. And the other thing that's interesting is the eigenvalue spectrum. Tells you what the length spectrum is. And this is due to the work of Gilman and Deustermat, that the set of lengths of closed geodesics, right? Without, you don't know the multiplicities, right? So if that, maybe that was your question. So for negative curvature, if you know the eigenvalue spectrum, you get out the set of lengths of closed geodesics. I mean, you get more information, but in particular, you know all the lengths of closed geodesics if you know the eigenvalue spectrum. So these are how they're, these different problems, some of which you've probably thought about before or seen before, and this conjugacy question are related to each other. So I'm sort of setting up the stage for now telling you what I know about the conjugacy question. So here are the results. Oh, I guess before results, I should say that everything's not conjugate. Everything isn't conjugacy rigid. And that comes back to the examples I mentioned before that Bruce Kleiner and I had. We have examples on BN, on the N ball, we constructed metrics that, the two metrics are not isometric. The geodesic flows are conjugate. The geodesic flows are the identity on the boundary. They preserve this contact form too. But that means you can cut and paste these examples into any manifold. So topologically, it's not a topological thing. Saying things are CK conjugate is about the metric. It's not about the topology. Any manifold admits pairs of metrics that are CK conjugate but not isometric, just by this local game. Geodesics here are trapped. Right, so everything, all the non-isometry stuff is going on locally here, but since there's no boundary, in some sense, the notion of trapped, every geodesic's trapped. All right, so you can't always do it. When is it? And the major open question, and this is really a dynamics question, if K is less than zero, is M C infinity or C zero conjugacy rigid? And this question was asked in, I guess it was posed as a conjecture, and I'll mention it's been solved in two dimensions by Katak. Here the geodesic flow is an off-off. It has some very nice properties, and we want to use these global properties of the geodesic flow, in some sense, to prove that balls are boundary rigid, little balls in your manifold. Okay, so that was the question. It was solved by myself and Otal independently for n equal to 2 and C0 conjugacy. So that is any negatively curved metric on a surface is determined up to C0 conjugacy by its geodesic flow. And then that was improved with Fatih and Feldman, also two dimensions. N is 2, curvature less than or equal to 0, and it's also C0 conjugacy. So again, it's a two-dimensional case. And then in higher dimensions, myself with Kleiner, that if M admits a parallel vector field, and I'll tell what it really is about in a second, then it's C1 conjugacy rigid. So, for example, typical example of a manifold that admits a parallel vector field, start with any Riemannian manifold, cross it with a circle. So the vertical direction, pointing in the circle direction, that'll be a parallel vector field. There are other examples, but they, at their core, they kind of look like this, that they have a parallel vector field. So even though there are lots of manifolds that aren't conjugacy rigid, stably in some weird sense, that is, if you cross them with S1, they suddenly become conjugacy rigid. And all subdomains of these guys are boundary rigid in particular. But the product structure is a pretty strong condition. There's really this local product structure with S1. That's what allows you to get away with this. And then, let's see, compact flat. Or C0, this, by the way, is only C1. That's not as good as C0, right? C0 conjugacy rigid is better. This, you need differentiability here to get this condition. Compact flat manifolds are C0 conjugacy rigid. No. Really, what's going on with that proof? If you already knew the other manifold you're looking at is a product, that's really the key step, is to show the other manifold is also a product. But once you see that it's a product, then as you start looking vertically, your conjugacy is sort of forced to cover a map on the base in some sense. Where's that vertical direction going to go? And all the ones nearly vertical, if you tried to make sort of just a any natural way of starting with a conjugacy on the base and trying to build one on the fiber, I mean on the product, you'd start looking at these vertical directions and all of these other, you'd sort of force a conjugacy on the original guy to cover a map on the base. That's what would happen. And the proof actually goes along those lines, but I wasn't going to digress to talk about that proof. So really the product structure is used very strongly in there. I mean, which is why you don't get a lot of, there aren't any nice consequences of using this by trying to build up. I guess this compact flat with Bruce Kleiner and I did something with this and Virago and Ivanov, and at the moment I'm not sure who to give credit to it for, but I'm lost now, but it's true. In any case, if you have a compact, any kind of flat manifold, it's C0 conjugacy rigid. Besson-Courtois-Gallot. Well, then you have to worry about what the conjugacy looks like asymptotically, probably. I mean, I haven't actually done that. Well, you can certainly ask all of these questions that instead of closing them up, you try and look at them asymptotically. I don't have answers for you for those. Question would be how rapidly. I mean, there are some of these problems I've given to graduate students to work on, and they didn't solve it. I'm sorry? I mean, it's an interesting question. One would suspect that it's true if you define asymptotically well enough, right? So I suspect exponentially decaying is fine, but really it should go like 1 over r squared. But I haven't worked out those details. But there should be some statement like that should be true. So you're talking about a method of, yeah, of solving it. I'm sure you could try that. I haven't done it. So I'd be sticking my neck way out if I was to say anything asymptotically, since I haven't actually done that. Besson-Courtois-Gallot, I mentioned these guys before in their proof of the minimal entropy conjecture, prove this for locally symmetric negatively curved spaces. Oops. Locally, and it's compact, of course. Everything's compact, at least at the moment. You can use this to get at any subdomain of a, and I mentioned this in the previous lecture, that boundary, that compact subdomains of a locally symmetric space are boundary rigid. And the proof, you can always glue any compact subdomain into a closed locally symmetric space. I mean, there's a little argument that has to be made. It's an algebraic argument. But you can always make arbitrarily large subdomains for your fundamental domains. So here's another example where you get I should have been a little careful about this. Compact locally symmetric spaces, curvature less than zero. Let me finish that off. These are going to be always C1 conjugacy rigid. And that was Besson-Courtois-Gallot. And is there C0 conjugacy rigid in the class of negatively curved spaces? Okay, so what do I mean by that? So from the dynamicist point of view, which is where this theorem is coming from, they're interested in negatively curved spaces. That's sort of their underlying assumption, is everything's negatively curved. And there's a, so the only comparison manifolds they sometimes consider are negatively curved manifolds. So for us, if you're talking about a inverse problems, you don't want to restrict the curvature of your comparison manifolds, which is why I'm making a distinction here. For the dynamicists, they don't mind at all restricting to negative curvature, so this is a nice result to get it down to C0. This was Hammerstadt. To get it down to C0. Surprisingly, what the question is, the difference in this case between the C0 and C1 cases is, are the total volumes the same? And that isn't known. If you just C0 conjugacy rigid, you don't know that the volumes of the manifolds are the same. That's an open question. It's even in the negatively curved setting, it's an open question, an important open question, is whether the volumes are the same. And what Hammerstadt proved was that if you were conjugate to a locally symmetric space, C0 conjugate to a locally symmetric space, then you had the same volume as that locally symmetric space. And that actually was quite an achievement. From the boundary rigidity question, it may not sound so impressive, because for us, we know the boundaries, the volumes are the same already. That's kind of given to us for free. So if you wanted to apply it to do the boundary rigid setting, you're fine. You can use the C0 result because you've got the volumes the same. Anyway, I'm going off on a strange tangent. Well, for one right here, right, this was the most important place for it, was to pass, to use the Besson-Courtois-Gallo conjugacy rigidity question, which was also a conjecture of Patak, I believe, maybe, that if two negatively curves, there's the conjecture that if you have the same geodesic flows, you're isometric. Okay. There's a conjecture, also not resolved, that if there are two natural measures that come with the flow. If you're talking about ergodicity, there's the, I'm going to get the names wrong, but there's the flow that gives you the topological entropy, and there's the Liouville measure that you're invariant under. And are those two measures the same? If those two measures are the same, then again, it's suspected that you're a rank one symmetric space. So that's another example where, in the long run, it turns out that knowing the volumes are the same if you're C0 conjugate is going to be an important ingredient in that conjecture. So it's just a number of conjectures, dynamical conjectures, have that as, you know, knowing the volumes are the same seems like it's a first step, but it's an important first step. I mean, I don't know if that's a good answer for you, but that's all I got. This has been extended a little bit by Farb and Connell to locally symmetric space, some locally symmetric spaces that are products. But I'm not going to write that down. There also is some results when both metrics have curvature less than or equal to zero. Higher rank spaces was done by myself and Eberlein and Kleiner. I did the graph manifold case. If you have three-dimensional graph manifolds, if they have, both of them have curvature less than or equal to zero and they're conjugate, then they're isometric. So there are some other examples, but I won't put them down since I won't have any time. And all cases that I mentioned here give you boundary rigidity for SGM submanifolds. They're all they don't need the smoothness condition of the simple. You can get by with SGM. All right. So that's the conjugacy question. I said I was going to run around and shift gears a couple of times. Now I'm going to shift to the linearized problem. So this is, as I said, it's a survey of what's known. What I know, maybe I shouldn't say that, but what I know about the boundary rigidity and its related questions. So the linearized problem, all right, it comes up naturally by looking at do there exist non-trivial families, G sub T, all of whom are non-trivial G sub T, all with, say, if we're doing the boundary distance function, DGT equal to DG 0. So can you deform the metric keeping the boundary distance function the same?
Sorry,
sure.
You mean to say that for C1, the volume issue is
not? Yeah, that Bruce Kleiner and I proved that in the parallel vector field case. In C1, it's not just us. Somebody else did that too. I don't remember now. But it's known that if you have a C1 conjugacy, the volume issue is resolved. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you know what Jacobi fields are, if you have C1, then Jacobi fields pass over to Jacobi fields, and then you have all the games you can play with Jacobi fields to help you out. So C0, you can sort of think of as trying to work with your hands, one hand tied behind your back, because you can't do the Jacobi field stuff. I should say, for negatively curved spaces, it may well be that a C0 conjugacy is automatically C infinity. I mean, this is just not known. It is proved in two dimensions that if it's, you have negatively curved, two negatively curved manifolds and a C0 conjugacy, Ornstein and Feldman proved that it's C infinity. So exactly how much this is a lack of our knowledge and how much is really a true lack of differentiability is not known. So here I'm going back to begin with. I'm starting with the boundary rigidity question, and then I'll talk about the conjugacy rigidity question linearized in a second. So we're going to look at the simple case. And we're going to look at general M tensors. So you have an M tensor on your manifold, and we, as Gunther mentioned today, we have the ray transform acts on C. This is the map, so it takes every geodesic, or you can parameterize by initial vector if you like, and it's going to integrate over the geodesic of the tensor. It's a symmetric tensor where you plug in gamma dot into every slot, dt. So this is going to be interesting to us mostly in the case m equals 0, 1, and 2. So functions, 1 forms, and 2 forms. Although some of the results are for n forms. And so this is the ray transform. These are symmetric. I probably said it but didn't write it. So these are symmetric M tensors. And in the linearized problem is essentially if the integral transform 0, is it 0? But of course, again, it's too strong. There is just as there are pullbacks of diffeomorphisms in the general question, here there's a question, well, We have an operator from symmetric M tensors to symmetric M plus 1 tensors, namely the symmetrized covariant derivative. And I'm not going to write it down. So, but it's an operator, and it's, if you take any tensor and take D of it, so here, this is 0 if C restricted the boundary is 0. So you have, this is the analog of the pulling back by diffeomorphisms. This is the infinitesimal pulling back by diffeomorphisms is what's going on here. So it's always the case that if you integrate D of C, you get 0. But in general, you can write C as its solenoidal and potential part. So let me, solenoidal plus D of some lower order tensor. We're here, this is the adjoint, the L2 adjoint of D, it's the divergence. So I'm not going to do much with the equations formally, I just want to set them up a little bit. And V has 0 when restricted to the boundary, right? V restricted to the boundary of M is 0. So there's a unique decomposition of any symmetric M tensor into the potential part and the solenoidal part. So the goal is to show that if I on a solenoidal part is 0, then the solenoidal part is 0. Right, that's really the linearized question. And the key ingredient in all of the results I know, what's known as Testov's identity, and it's called Testov's identity because Shatafudinov wrote about it first. Testov and Shatafudinov worked on this together, but afterwards Shatafudinov wrote some other papers and he got to refer to it as Testov's identity, so now it's known as Testov's identity, but my impression is they were developed by the two of them together, Testov and Shatafudinov. Is that correct? Oh, okay, so it goes back to the, and it's the key ingredient in all of the proofs. As I said, I'm not going to do any proofs today. I think of it as a Bochner-type argument, but that's just me. But basically what it means is there's a local formula. You're going to integrate over your manifold, and a bunch of divergence pieces disappear, and you get some consequences. That's the kind of argument that it is, that all of these things turn out to be. They use Testov's and modified Testov's identity. So there are various ways, but that, without telling you what that is, I'll just tell you that that's the key ingredient. Now I'll tell you some of the results. So what's true? And again, we're in the simple case, let me. That it's true for M equal to 0 and M equal to 1. That is, for functions, functions are determined by their integrals along geodesics in the simple case. This was Mokhometov. And independently Bernstein and Gerber. And this was in the 80s. And then for M equals 1, it's Anikonov and Romanov, apparently in 76. Although I haven't quite figured out this proof yet after staring at it for a while. But there it is. There is a paper, and it actually exists in English. But the original 76 paper is in Russian. So for one forms, and this actually plays an important ingredient in Gunther's proof, in some sense, you can do the one-dimensional, you can bootstrap your way in that one-dimensional. One tensors. You can sometimes use nice arguments, really nice arguments, I like those arguments, to get it to do second-order things. But this is the first, for one forms, it's always true. And then for all n, m, by the way, m equal to 2 is the boundary rigidity question, the linearized boundary rigidity question. You're talking about two tensors, your metric tensors. So for all m, it's true if the curvature is less than or equal to 0. And this is due to Pastoff. Shout out to Dina. This was somewhere around 88. And this has been extended in a number of directions to weaker curvature conditions. It doesn't have to be always less than or equal to 0. There's an extension in the two-dimensional case by Sharafutdinov and Ullmann to the case of no focal points, which is a generalization of this, and the geodesic flow being an Ossoff. So there are, this is simple, and no focal points. All right, so this is, so this says that for curvature less than 0 or for those extensions, that there is no deformation of the metric, which leaves the boundary distances the same. That's the point of this. It's an infinitesimal version. And I want to mention, well, how am I doing here? Oh, geez. What do I have to? I'm trying to remember. Oh. I started 10 minutes later, sorry. So I get to quarter of. Is that what it is? No, that's too far. Okay. Well, when did I start? 12:15, 12:20 I started. Okay, so I'll just... All right, maybe I'll skip this one then. Let me see what... Instead of giving you applications of this, let me mention what it says for this similar argument, what it gives you in the conjugacy case. So now you have a compact Riemannian manifold of negative curvature. So the curvature is now less than 0, mg compact. Then again, you get the decomposition into solenoidal part and potential part, and you're trying to see, in this case, the linearized problem is to look at the transform where you integrate over all closed geodesic gamma. So here now gamma is closed. Geodesic of again the symmetrized, I mean the plug in gamma dot into all the slots, and you integrate with respect to arc length around each closed geodesic. And if this is zero for the solenoidal part, is that zero? That's the linearized problem. And again, this is true in this case. True. And that was myself and Sharafutdinov. And one of the consequences of this was isospectral deformations. There do not exist isospectral. Deformations from a curvature-less than zero manifold. That is, if you start with a manifold with curvature less than or strictly less than zero, and if you look at the spectrum, eigenvalue spectrum, if you deform the metric in such a way that the eigenvalue spectrum doesn't change, then all of those metrics are isometric to each other. That's what comes out of this. There are isospectral deformations in positive curvature, or in using nilpotent groups. So the existence of isospectral deformations in general happen, but there are no isospectral deformations in negative curvature. By the way, I've got all of these. They're all the same in this case. For deformations, you could have also asked, does the length spectrum deform? It's really the same answer. And does the Mark length spectrum deform? They're all really the same question in negative curvature as far as deformations. Is that a question? And I should say this. Gilman and Kasdan really started this in the 80s. They did the two-dimensional case, proved no isospectral deformations, and they proved the n-dimensional case under a stronger curvature assumption. And they also showed that the same ideas, and we also get this result, you can look at Schrodinger equations for these compact manifolds without boundary and ask if the spectra are the same, can you determine the potentials? And that also is true in negative curvature under an extra assumption. So the potential is Q1 is equal to Q2 if spectra are the same, if we have what's called simple length spectrum. That is, all geodesics, two geodesics always have different lengths. Right? There are no two geodesics of the same length, closed geodesics. And that's a generic condition, generically. So this is really goes back to the arguments in Gilman-Kasdan, but they needed all the extra curvature assumptions, and this drops out now. In essence, they prove that what you get from the spectrum is the integrals along every closed geodesic of the Qs of the potentials, if it's simple. And so the M equal 1 case, in some sense, of this theorem works. All right. No, you don't need the simplicity of the spectrum. Only comes out. Okay, so there you don't need it because in deformations, nothing's allowed. No lengths are allowed to move. But the Mark length spectrum stays the same if the length spectrum stays the same in deformations. And so knowing the eigenvalue spectrum stays the same tells you the length spectrum stays the same, but that actually tells you the whole Mark length spectrum stays the same because no geodesic can jump to another spot. So you're really, really stuck that way. But here, what you actually find from Gilman and Kasdan's argument is that if you look at all geodesics of a given length, what you get is the integral of Qs added over all those geodesics. That's the data you get out. And that's not the same as knowing them over every length. So you really do need to have the simplicity for the case of determining the potential. Simplicity of spectrum. Oh, no, not the eigenvalue spectrum. Doesn't give you simplicity of the length spectrum, no. No, that's the relationship between the eigenvalue spectrum and the length spectrum is rather complicated. And these results, I did it with the less than or equal to zero. Again, they were extended to an Ossoff geodesic flow with no focal points in two dimensions by Ullmann and Sharapudinov. And in n dimensions for an Ossoff and curvature less than or equal to zero instead of less than zero by Sharapudinov. So there are some extensions of this result. All right, maybe I'll say things without writing anything since I'm sure people are tired by now. So I'm going to skip the applications, but just mention that this is the deformation question, which is interesting, but there's also the local question. That is, if two metrics are nearby, I mean, you ask the you want the global question, right? But you settle for what you can get, and one thing you can hope to get is the local question. For instance, I hate to mention a local question I can't solve, but if you could get at the local question for isospectral deformations, which I have no hope for getting at, but say you could, instead of deformations, you do local, then you'd be able to prove in lots of cases that for a given manifold, there are only finitely many other isospectral manifolds to it, which is a conjecture. Even in negative curvature, a given manifold, there are isospectral, non-isometric manifolds. There are examples. We know they don't come in one-parameter families here, but are they discrete? And hence, in certain compact, natural compact families, finite. And so moving from deformations to local is an important step here. And we haven't done it here, but there are some results. Okay, let me just say that there are some results by myself and Ullmann and Sharapudinov and Lasas. I'm leaving somebody off. But a number of different results showing that in some cases you do get some local uniqueness for the boundary distance function. And maybe I should just end there. Getting late and it's Friday afternoon. Thank you. I'm not exactly sure how to think. Well, in the nonlinear case, right, you're trying to mod out by the diffeomorphism group, right? In general, there isn't, but in some special cases, I mean, you look for harmonic representatives. So sometimes you can do that in some problems. Right, that's what I'm doing, minimize the energy function to get our harmonic representative. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, especially in negative curvature, their harmonic maps are unique. So you get the... Well, okay, so the reason that we get the answers in negative cases is because we can prove them. We don't have counterexamples in positive case, and of course, in two dimensions, It's just been essentially solved in the simple case. It's always true. This was the thing we were talking about this morning. So, but in higher dimensions, it's an open question. There are some things that you can do. Now I want to say, what examples do we know of global? There's the hemisphere, the subdomains of the hemisphere has got positive curvature. So there are some places where, if you look at anything cross S1, subdomains of that are boundary rigid. So it's not as if the negative curvature is essential. There are some boundary rigid things that have positive curvature. It's just what we can prove. And how far it goes, the conjecture is any SGM manifold in any dimension is boundary rigid. That's the conjecture. We're not there. Yeah.
Think about the local vector dimension here that would imply a finite number of. Is that the same? Being for the boundary is the problem, or is it true? A local vector everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's where we do prove local results, right? So, right. You have to set up the compactness, right? So it's local uniqueness plus compactness gives you finiteness, right? Just topological statement. So, well, there is a compactness statement we had. There are various compactness statements. There you go. You have to set up the topology a priori. So the results that are known, I mean, I could make statements right now, finiteness statements, by taking the local results that we know and I never said anything about, and coming up with topologies that are compact and saying if in the class of metrics that satisfy this, this, and this, there are only finitely many things that have the same boundary distance function. Those kind of theorems you can construct already. I mean, no, but I don't think people have written them down yet. We're planning on writing some of those down, but we haven't yet. But there are finiteness theorems you can get from those local. There are actually global results. Well, I'll tell you privately. But maybe some of the things I was going to talk about where you can take this deformation and make it prove a global result for you. So there are some things like that you can do.